WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshall guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going to be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi. Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
Oh, welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Remember, if you miss any of the segments, we do our best to put them up on the website, 959WATD.com, and scroll down, click on Monday Night Talk. You'll be able to hear some of the latest segments. We have, as we teased you, before traffic, State Rep Josh Cutler, 6th Plymouth District, here.
Good evening.
So Mr. Mike Cogburn. You guys ready for the holidays?
Nope. Nope. No. In fact, I'm going after this to do some shopping.
Attaboy. Attaboy. So the thought was we wanted to have you come in. I mean, it's a regular thing here on this program to have elected officials, and you guys are all great here on the South Shore, coming in and chatting about things that you're working on, things, your concerns. But we also like to at least highlight things when you guys do special things. And I know that there was a collective effort to do something in remembrance of Tiny Brown, a beloved friend, yes, business owner, a guy, a man of the community who left us too soon. So what's going on? From we understand, you were able to get some legislation onto the governor's desk?
Yes. So, in fact, just today, in fact, the governor received a bill that was passed by both houses of the legislature, thanks to my colleagues, Vinny DiMicito, and my colleagues in the House as well. And this bill, which I drafted and filed, it would dedicate an intersection in the town of Pembroke to the late Tiny Brown, father of our esteemed co-host, who was someone that I got to know and really appreciate, and the community, and I think, you know, I'm not alone, obviously. Mm-hmm. He was his nickname was Tiny, but, you know, he had a giant heart, mm-hmm, and he did a tremendous amount for the community, the whole South Shore, really. He served his country, he served the town in many ways, so just we wanted to find a way to pay our respects and to pay our remembrances to Tiny, and so this was an idea that we came up with, and the Brown family was kind enough to go along with our idea. We appreciate that.
I fought him, though. He texted me. He says, "You got to be at the selectmen's meeting on Monday."
Yes.
Go, why? And he tells me, I said, "No."
Why? Why would you say no?
Well, I don't know. My dad was kind of, he was a background guy. He just liked to be in the background. And he, you know, Josh, when he wanted something done, he'd call you first. And, but, you know, Josh explained to me it wasn't about my dad, it was about the people who he helped. And people wanted to remember him and honor him. And I was honored when he told me about it. It was pretty awesome.
So we appreciate that. And so so we filed the bill this fall and able to get through in an expedited fashion because the clock runs out at the end of the calendar year, December 31st.
Session,
so we had to get it done. So thankfully our colleagues, were very cooperative. And again, it was co-sponsored by the whole South Shore delegation, even though I filed it was really a team effort. And we got it passed in the House, passed in the Senate, and it was finally enacted, which is sort of the final step in the process, and it has been sent to the governor. He hasn't signed it yet. That's just simply a matter of time. We were already in communication with the governor's staff, and I expect that shouldn't be an issue. And we've been talking to MassDOT, and now it's just a question of kind of determining when we're going to try to
date
this up
time.
And set a time. It'll most likely be this spring. We'll have a formal dedication, and we'll obviously make make everyone aware, and we hope WATD will be there to join us. Yeah. Obviously, the Brown family will be a big part of that, yeah. And we'll have all the folks in the community come and come together, and probably a nice day to remember a great Pembrokean.
And will there be some hot rods in it as well?
You and some of his friends have already found out when we were talking about it through Facebook, and they have this whole party that they want to do, and we got to kind of quell it down because I don't think we can fit that many hot rods on the corner. But they're all looking forward to it. And one of the biggest things in his legacy was that he got to see the property across the street get bought for the fire station. And it's going to be a nice corner, so it's going to be good.
Absolutely.
And thank you.
And just a reminder, so folks who don't know, where exactly will
this be? So, yeah, thank you.
Be?
Thank you, Kevin. So this is going to be in Pembroke on the corner of Route 14 and 53. It's right near, there's a gas station and a firehouse nearby, and actually the Brown home is nearby. So it's a very appropriate location. It's sort of the welcome to Pembroke corridor in a sense. And so it'll be nice to have the Tiny Brown Memorial be the welcoming to Pembroke symbol. So I think that'll be very appropriate in many ways.
Very definitely good. Fantastic.
It is fantastic.
How do you feel about it, Peter?
I just remember when we were growing up as kids, my father being, you know, Smokey the Bear, and he was on Engine 3, was right across the street. Every time the fire horn would call, he'd be running across the street and all, you know, half his gear, trying to get the rest of his gear on. And everybody knew where my father's house was in the town, and it was just a welcoming. My father welcomed everybody, and it's just a good spot for us. Really, I was very thoughtful of you. I appreciate it.
Definitely, so, very cool. Anything else besides that you have in the works that you're working on, or you kind of got everything?
Most of what
up?
We're doing right now, Kevin, is really kind of gearing up for the next session, which starts. We get sworn in for the new term on January 4th. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our efforts now is, you know, getting our bills together and so forth for that. There are, of course, a few things that need to be done before the end of this year. One of which is this bill,
right.
And there's some other things percolating as well. But for the most part, we're kind of looking ahead to get things ready for the new session, which will start, you know, as soon as Christmas rolls around. It'll be right upon us. Be back to work.
Interesting that you talk about new legislation, and the first thing that I think of is, for some reason,
this is going to sound odd.
I don't know why the heck they're doing that. Just sometimes people don't realize, and it's okay. Speaking of legislation, I see this as being,
You didn't catch his joke, but go on.
That's all right. I'll catch it later. When I re-listen to it, as I shake my fist at you in the end, that. Segueing from talking about cleaning things up for this year and looking for new legislation to file next year, we look and we see, here we are a couple of days since recreational marijuana.
Yes.
The law took effect.
Right, it's in effect.
What are you hearing from? I mean, are you hearing from law enforcement and from people who have concerns that this is moving forward? Again, there are those who are for it and they sure want to see this happen, but there are others who are concerned in regards to what's going to happen moving forward, because there still are more steps to happen.
So I think, you know, and regardless of what opinions we all came into this, you know, at the beginning of the process, you know, we sort of have to check those at the door because the law was passed. It's the law of the land, and we obviously have to respect that, and I do, even if it wasn't my choice. As you said, Kevin, on this past Thursday, the portions of the new the legalization of marijuana law went into effect in terms of home growth and possession. But there's some other aspects of the law that will come on board over the next year. One of the big things is going to be appointing this new Cannabis Control Commission, which will sort of be the organization that oversees all the regulations dealing with of marijuana. And so appointments to that commission will be made in March of this year by our state treasurer. And then once that happens, then they'll be able to move forward with the other sort of regulatory framework. If you think about it, Kevin, you know, the voters passed this ballot referendum, and even though it was a fairly lengthy referendum, it was the broad strokes of the law. And you have to kind of fill in with the regulations, and that's sort of very typical of a lawmaking process. And so it takes some time to obviously fill in, you know, how are the details of this going to be worked out? I've already gotten calls from my police chiefs asking about, you know, what kind of controls can we have here at the local level to exercise our local discretion about whether we want to allow certain types of establishments or how many or where we should put them, and all those types of questions. And so the law addressed the broad strokes of that, but it doesn't get into the details, and that's you know, just by reality. So the regulations will really dive into the details of that and determine how this is going to work on a, you know, sort of daily nitty-gritty basis. So the regulatory framework is going to be important, and that's going to move forward once these folks are appointed to this new Cannabis Control Commission, which will be expected to be in March.
Now, Mike, being somebody who has worked hard diligently, this group of Pembroke residents who put together a group, have done a lot of fundraising, a lot of work to get to put awareness out there. What's your thoughts? Do you feel that this is kind of a step back in the process of trying to rid the community society of addiction, or is it just, you know what, it's just stuff happens?
Yeah, well, it doesn't change what we're trying to do, right? So,
well, it depends, and I'll tell you why. Is that there's an argument to be made, and it depends on who you ask. Some folks feel that marijuana is a gateway drug to harder substances.
Yeah.
Others will tell you, no, maybe something like alcohol might be more the leading cause for someone to go harder. So that's why I asked.
So, well, and this is my personal opinion. This is not necessarily that of the Titans Against Drugs Foundation or its board. But, you know, I don't feel that it is going to help the situation any. That being said, marijuana was decriminalized a few years back, right? I've heard District Attorney Cruz talk about the fact that there's no one that is in jail for possession of marijuana since 2008. That's, you know, 9 years now, close to it. So in the sense that whether or not it is a gateway drug, and I'm not the expert on that, I'm just someone that started a foundation that knew that drugs aren't a good idea. So it really doesn't matter to us. Our mission is still the same, which is to help educate the youth in our community, help encourage them to make healthy decisions and good choices, just as we wouldn't encourage teens in the community to drink alcohol. We feel that, you know, we want to show them the reasons why it's not necessarily a good idea and what it could lead to. Same thing with marijuana. So regardless of the debate, we still have the same message. We still are trying to bring the same types of messages to the community, and especially our kids.
That's a great point, Mike. And, you know, it's important, you know, to point out, obviously, this new law only legalizes marijuana for people that are 21 or older. So, hopefully this will bring it out of the shadows. And, you know, obviously people smoking marijuana long before this ballot question was passed.
Or eating marijuana.
Or whatever the case may
marijuana.
Be. And that actually brings up another point. Folks have asked, well, you know, what is the legislature going to do? And, you know.
Well, the proponents are fearful of that.
I think so, right. Understandably. And I think, you know, I can't predict the future, but I don't suspect the legislature is going to make any drastic changes to the law because, you know, again, this was passed. This is the will of the voters, and right. You know, we are in the business of doing the voters' will. So, I suspect there will be some changes made around the edges in places where there are maybe gaps in the law or things that it needs to be tightened up. Two areas, one of which is the edibles area. We've already talked about that. That is something that is a concern of mine. And I think was not properly or fully addressed in the ballot question. I'm very concerned about, you know, packaging and labeling, and that, you know, these sort of gummy bear type things don't get packaged in a way that look like they're kids' candy. So I think there's definitely a possibility that we'll be addressing that. The revenue levels, nobody's ever for higher taxes, but in this case, I mean, they might want to take a look at that, because the marijuana tax as it currently would exist is 10%. We include the sales tax plus the excise tax, and then is a 2% option at the local level.
Option, right.
That would make it the lowest. It is the lowest in the country.
Right, because I think Washington State and Colorado.
Three times.
Much higher.
Three times.
48%. That's going to be our question.
So, I mean, there's room to make some modest adjustments without, you know, taxing it to to extinction. So that's an area that we might look at that I think proponents may not be thrilled with, but I think, you know, there has to be a discussion about that. You know, this is whatever money brings in has to at least pay for the costs of administering and regulating this. I mean, that's at a minimum in my view. And it's you know, to be determined whether that currently is viable with what the levels that they're set at right now. So we do have a little bit of work cut out for us, I think. And I think, you know, that's appropriate, and that's what we should be doing. And we'd be, I think, abdicating our responsibility if we didn't at least take some initiative here.
Just want to make sure that I pay my respects. So Michael Faherty is joining us as he was on last week, and I invited him to kind of come and sit in and be a part of it. So if he chimes in, you hear his voice. He's here. We're going to give him
welcome.
How you doing?
He's going to at each break. We're going to give away. He'll dictate what the tickets will be.
Yep.
Be clear, because Larry's our gentleman in the other room is going to be the one who has to write the folks' name down. So we're going to give away. If we're going to give away a pair of tickets, we'll make sure
we're going to give away as many as we can.
Now, what are we talking about here?
This
what
is
kind of tickets?
The Wonder of Christmas. This is a Christmas celebration that happens in Brockton from the 16th to the 23rd. It's happening
Friday,
right now.
Yep.
Happening tonight, so we just want to, you know, give away some free tickets.
The production is less one, but it's for a good cause.
That's right, it's less one because
Michael is here. But
well,
Michael
thank you for
would,
joining us.
Michael would be playing the role of we don't want to reveal it. But we're glad that you're here, and you'll also be.
So
part
in the
of
midst of the serious conversation, we do have some fun, and you know,
right. So we definitely will look forward for you'll ask questions and be kind of a prototypical co-host with Peter Brown. Peter,
yes.
Did you have a question, whether it be for Mike or for Josh?
I'm
in regards
just curious.
To
now that it's legal in the state, what about the federal level? How is that going to work? As far as
that's another hill you're going to have to figure out how to climb.
That's a great question for your later guest. How about that for a segue, Congressman Lynch?
Actually,
No, seriously, that's a question, because under federal law, it's still legal, and we have a new attorney general who'll be coming in. Who I think has a different view on this than our current attorney general. So. What is going to happen there is, you know, up in the air a little bit. I think I think the ship has sort of sailed in terms of, you know, whether or not we're going to go back to the old days on that. But it is a fair question, and certainly something that affects banking and credit card use. And that's why some of these organizations have to use cash. That it does add a whole layer of complexity to the whole marijuana regulation issue.
Yeah, because I remember some of the seminars that we were going to through the summer with Vinny and Josh and you and Michael were talking about the legality of it and the out west atmosphere that Colorado had because of the federal level.
Right, you have to have, you know, they have a lot of private security because you're dealing with an all-cash business. So
I'm correct, wasn't California one of the first states to actually be selling marijuana?
They were one of the first to do medical marijuana.
I want to say there was a either a documentary or a 60-minute piece that was on, and there were a lot of questions as to, you know, how this would mesh with the federal. And there were a lot of those conversations that were had in regards to, you know, how the funding, and if it has anything to do with the feds, well, it wouldn't happen because of, you know, the federal government.
You know, obviously other states have managed to work this out, and we will as well. It's not unsolvable. Yeah. But it's just, you know, it adds another layer of discussion and complexity.
Yes.
Any plans for PTED, Mike, in the new year with some of the things that you guys are looking at to do for 2017?
We're in planning right now for late winter, early spring, and maybe some summer activities. But we first and foremost are right now, we're actually trying to schedule Chris Herron to come back to talk to our middle school students. And then
this is his first or second time? How many times have you enlisted in the services?
This would be his second.
How was the first time?
It was phenomenal. So the reaction was great. He spoke to the entire Pembroke High School student body during the day, and then came back at night for an open to the public session. We had almost 600 people at that second session too. So I think it was well worth it. So we're looking to schedule to bring him back, and then some other programs, both during and after school. We traditionally have gone into the sixth grade classrooms on the last day of elementary school, and with some high school kids, some kind of leaders, to talk about making good decisions, and we do a drug-free pledge with them. So we'll be doing that as well, and then we send typically 20 to 25 kids to DARE camp, regional DARE camp as well. So we've got some other ideas that we're vetting internally and you know, securing budget for and funding and all that good stuff, but little by little.
Folks want to get involved with Pembroke Titans Against Drugs? How website or if they want to make a donation?
Sure.
In kind for the holiday season?
Website is titansagainstdrugs.org. We're always on Facebook if you want to message us or learn more about what we have to say there as well. Send us a message.
Representative, anything in closing? Do you have any grievances?
Merry Christmas.
To air? Nothing, huh?
Okay. I have no Christmas, grievances.
Right. No grievances to air at this particular time. I want to thank both of you for coming in. At least,
yes, thank you, Josh.
At least stimulating the conversation, and we look forward to having you in 2017, whether it's to promote more things that PTAD is doing.
Thank you.
Pembroke Titans Against Drugs. Of course, State Rep Josh Cutler, always quick to come in and join us and discuss some of the issues and topics that are going on affecting his district and the South Shore and the Commonwealth in general.
Well, thank you for having us on, and we wish our listeners out there, since we won't be able to be back again, a Merry Christmas and a very peaceful New Year.
Yes, thank you very much.
Michael, it's your time to shine for a moment here. How many tickets do you want to give away?
Don't go
crazy now, because remember, we've got Larry's in there. He's going to have to write down the names.
So we have two types of tickets. We have single tickets, and they're only $5 a piece. So we can, you know, we can give away a couple of those. But if you have a family,
let's do a fair. If somebody calls in,
yep,
and they say I have a family, we'll give them a 4-pack.
Okay.
Do they need to answer trivia? No, no. Just gonna call and give Larry their name so they can pick them up, and they'll have to come here to pick them up.
Okay.
To come here, 130 Enterprise Drive. They're gonna call 781-837-4900. That's the way they'll do it.
Okay.
Larry will write down their name, and
if they are interested, it's
I think we should have a secret code word.
That's what this is all about.
The wonder of Christmas.net if they are interested.
We're going to step aside. Our next guest is warming up in the bullpen, but gentlemen, Representative Mike, thank you very much for coming, and thank you for displaying your feats of strength for us for Festivus, of course. You're listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. We will be right back in just a moment.
Jesus is King, loud we proclaim with one accord. The happy tale, welcome the Lord. Ring Christmas bells, sound far and near.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD. Follow Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. And our next conversation, we get a chance to kind of talk a little bit about we've been hearing in the news in regards to politics, talking a little bit about the Russian government and how they could have possibly had a role in who ended up being chosen our next president. And our next guest is actually calling for a bipartisan oversight investigation into those reports of Russian cyber espionage. We have Congressman Stephen Lynch joining us. Congressman, welcome back to Monday Night Talk, my friend.
Merry Christmas, Kevin. Good to be with you again.
Merry Christmas to you. I also have Peter Brown, who's my co-host. He's one of our local businessmen.
Merry Christmas, Congressman.
Merry Christmas.
And another gentleman from your district, Michael Faherty, who actually is here to promote and give away tickets to the Wonder of Christmas taking place in the city of Brockton.
God bless you, Michael. Thank you.
good to hear you, Congressman.
Congressman, so I kind of set it up, and it gives you a chance to kind of swing and knock it out of the park. Give us the details in regards to this letter that you sent to the chairman of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee in regards to requesting the committee commence an investigation into these reports.
Sure. Well, it's a committee I serve on, so I'm the ranking Democrat on the National Security Subcommittee, so I know him fairly well. This is Chairman Jason Chaffetz from Utah. And I just felt that there was not enough official information on what exactly had happened. There were four different intelligence agencies that reported on this, but none of them were really conclusive. No briefings were offered to Congress. None have been given to us as of yet. There was a statement made by James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, but even he was unwilling to confirm the reports of the CIA in this case. So we just think that a full and far-flung investigation should be conducted. There are a lot of different jurisdictions here, not just cybersecurity, but also the Justice Committee is also interested, and also International Relations Committee is interested. There are a few senators, including Mr. Schumer and I think Mr. McCain, that want to have a select committee in the Senate investigate this. But we think it should be all hands on deck. Everybody should try to look under every stone here and try to get the complete menu of facts that are out there as to what actually transpired. Up to this point, Director Clapper is not saying that this was just the Russians trying to help Donald Trump and hurt Hillary. He's saying that it looks more like an effort to just disrupt the election in any way they could. So we'd like to see the whole thing laid out for us so that we can make a firm assessment on what was actually going on here.
If we do find out that, in fact, this is true, that the Russians were, tapping into emails and that they were being disruptive in this manner, what then? Do we look for sanctions? I mean, is it a matter of punishing Russia in some manner, a way of making sure that this never happens again, and also wards off other countries or other factions that may want to attempt such a thing in the future?
Well, unfortunately, this happens a lot around the world.
Mm.
Interference by providing information regarding, I know that there was a lot of U.S. press about the amount of Putin's wealth during his last election. Not that it was a legitimate election, but there was a lot of what they would describe as interference with their election as well.
Hmm.
There are countless other countries in Africa and the Middle East that would say that we have interfered with their elections as well. So, there's one thing about, publicity and free speech, and we respect that, but in this case it seems that the concerted effort to hack into the Democratic National Committee was a purposeful attempt to undermine one particular candidate, and that was Hillary Clinton. So we'd like to get more facts before we make a full assessment here, but it's a serious charge here. I think we should be asking ourselves what the next steps might be.
Mm.
And I think that certainly sanctions could be considered, but I would rather get the facts first before we cast a verdict.
How long would it take? I mean, is it quick for the chairman to render a decision to go forth with this? And if he does set a precedent where it's something that is, I would believe that the committee would have to take a vote to do that if he does put that effort forth, right?
Right. I think they'll definitely have they'll have hearings on this.
Okay.
There's no question in my mind on that.
How long? What are we looking at for a time frame if there are hearings?
Well, Mr. Clapper has said that the investigation is still ongoing,
okay,
and he would like for us to have all the information before we have a hearing, and that to give the intelligence services the ability to figure out what exactly happened, then have a hearing. So we're not due back into Washington until January 3rd, so I would hope that by that time they would be ready with, if not a final conclusion to their investigation, then certainly a preliminary report on what they've got so far. By January 3rd, I think it would be, or January 4th would be a reasonable expectation.
Okay. Speaking with Congressman Stephen Lynch, Shapina, did you have a question?
Yeah, because I just the new administration that's going to be coming in after January 20th, and you're seeing some of the tweets that he's throwing out about the accusations they were going for the election. And how is the investigation going to be, is that, is it, do you think the administration would impede it?
Would it hinder the investigation, yeah, you think?
Well, he's been dismissive and in tweets. I wish it had knocked that off, but it doesn't seem like he gave much forethought before he tweeted out that he didn't believe his own CIA and that he wasn't going to accept daily intelligence briefings. If there's anybody on the planet that needs intelligence briefings, it's probably
Commander
Donald Trump. He's brand new. You know, my hope, as a moderate Democrat, my hope was, okay, you know, I would just hope that Donald Trump would hire good people and then listen to them. And, you know, so far, you know, he's made some questionable choices. But the big sin here would be if he assumed that he knew everything and didn't listen to anyone.
Right.
You know, I think he's he's really putting a lot at risk if you go out there without a good, solid sense of what the intelligence is and what the consequences of your statements might bring. Mm.
Michael, question.
Congressman, beyond hacking, the president-elect, his cabinet, his picks have been very pro-Russia. Does that concern you in any way, the ongoing relationship with Russia and the new ties that we'll have to them?
Well, you know, he was going to drain the swamp. And, you know, since then, he's picked about five guys from Goldman Sachs and the CEO from ExxonMobil.
Right.
So, you know, those guys are the kings of the swamp. You know, that's not draining the swamp. And you're right. There are some solid connections there with the Russian government. I think the Exxon CEO received an award from the Russian government, which is troubling. So I would hope that. I would hope that he would realize what Russia has done recently in Crimea, what they've done recently in eastern Ukraine, what they've done recently in Syria. Those actions should have consequences, and it doesn't appear to be sinking in with Mr. Trump.
When you look at this incoming administration, you yourself, as a veteran of Washington, D.C., and somebody who has fought for a lot of different things for your district, what are some of the things that you're hoping, the areas that this new administration is going to address, and not just agendas, but areas of importance?
Well, I would hope, you know, I would like to see us working together. I really would. We're going to have President Trump for at least 4 years. Let's work on some things that you know, we can get support from Democrats and Republicans and support some of the things that America really needs. One of the areas I think that is fertile for meaningful discussion is tax reform. Now, I know, you know, we may look at things differently, but I really do think there is a majority of Democrats and a majority of Republicans that would sit down and try to work out a tax reform piece. And part of that could be the fact that we have, for U.S. companies, we've got about $11 trillion overseas. And if we worked out some agreement where we allowed those companies to repatriate that money back into the United States with a tax of, say, you know, 14%, that's what they've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
that would give us, over the next 10 years, about $1.3 trillion, and we could use that for a major infrastructure bill that would help every city and town and state in America to rebuild their infrastructure, which has been lagging for such a long time. Now, that would put a lot of people to work. It's something that Trump has talked about that he'd like to do. So I just think if you started off with two things, let's just say tax reform and then infrastructure, those are two major policy pieces that he could put wins up on the board with both of those, and then go forward. So and I think he'd get a buy-in from the majority of Democrats on the other side. You're not going to get everybody, obviously, but but I bet he could get more than 50% of Democrats to support both of those measures.
Right. Well, we know the cornerstone of Barack Obama's, his 8 years in office, some of the work that he did when he initially took office was to make sure that Americans had health care, the Affordable Care Act. Now, there was talk during the campaign that the Trump administration would dismantle this or would reform it. Your thoughts on any work to dismantle or reform the ACA as it stands?
Well, we're going to have to fix it because the costs are spiraling out of control. We see even here in Massachusetts, I think there's only one plan left now that will allow you to be seen at the Brigham and Women's and the Mass General Hospital. Doctors are not accepting the Affordable Care Act. We're already seeing the premiums skyrocket, and looks like it's just getting worse. So it needs to be fixed. I think even the president said, "Look, we got to fix this. It's not working the way it was supposed to."
Mm-hmm.
So if we had an approach that we were going to try to provide affordable health care, that'd be great. I think that, having Tom Price as your Secretary of HHS, he's a doctor, he's a physician, but he has a very, very dim view of the Affordable Care Act and is not in favor of government intervention in the healthcare system. He thinks it should be between the doctor and the patient. And of course, the Affordable Care Act is all about government control. So it's going to be a tough time trying to reconcile those views.
Last quick question, Mike. You have one to follow up?
I don't. I thought this was a very enlightening conversation. Very good.
Well, it's always good to have the congressman on. Probably the last question I would ask you, Congressman, have you done all of your holiday shopping?
No, absolutely not. I've got a couple left. I've got brother-in-law and a nephew that are tough to pick out stuff for. So, but I've got all the women in my life and my wife and my girls. And we're looking forward to a wonderful holiday, a wonderful Christmas. And I wish the same to your families and all the families of your listeners. Merry Christmas and a healthy and happy New Year.
As back to you as well, Congressman. We thank you for joining us and keeping the folks here in the district up to date and informed on some of the things that you're working on and striving for.
Thank you, Kevin.
You got
it. Good to be with you.
There he is. So Congressman Stephen Lynch has been our guest for that segment, and we're going to step aside. But before we do...
Before we do.
What are we going to do, Michael?
Wonder of Christmas. We're going to give away a family ticket. This one ticket is good for four more people. The Wonder of Christmas.net with six separate Christmas activities going on for your family.
All right. And all you can do is call 781-837-4900. It's that easy. You call in and Larry will take your name and we'll make sure you're going to come and pick them up, though, here at 130 Enterprise Drive.
That's right.
We're going to step aside. When we come back, more Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
Thank you.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com, the South Shore's news, weather, and traffic station. Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk.
And we are back here on Monday Night Talk, the second hour. Monday Night Talk, of course. We're going to hear from Casey Sherman, author and owner of a production company. Get his take on a number of things he's working on. We'll also hear from Mr. George Earl from Marshfield Community Christmas. Kind of give that last push. And, of course, we have a Michael Faherty here with Wonder of Christmas.
That's right.
In Brockton at 1090 West Chestnut Street. Giving away tickets. Be prepared. Your next chance coming up in about 20 minutes by calling 781-837-4900. And you'll have to come here to pick the tickets up. That's the deal. But Michael is giving them away. Before we go on and introduce our next guest, I do want to take a moment to wish Mr. Edward Perry a very happy birthday. It
yes,
is his birthday.
Happy birthday.
Josh was mentioning that. I did miss the celebrity birthdays this morning. Yes. It was very, very early, but we want to wish our beloved owner
Well, you were thinking about him, though. I could tell.
I was.
Yeah.
I was. While
so
I was,
he'll forgive
while me. I was counting sheep.
Yes.
But happy birthday to Edward Perry.
Yes.
So we move forward, and joining us is Attorney Adam Bond. He's also a gentleman who does his own radio show down in the Taunton area. An attorney that we've had on from time to time to talk a couple of different things. He's going to join us to give us a little bit of an update on where things stand regarding the battle over a tribal casino in Taunton, where this thing was. There was a lawsuit, and the residents were successful, but yet there's been an update. Good evening, Adam. How are you?
Good evening. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
And happy Hanukkah.
And happy Festivus to the rest of us, my friend.
Yes.
Do you have any grievances to air? Do we have enough time?
No, I don't. I don't. I nope. mean, I, I'm not. I, I'm not. I, I'm not sure about Festivus, but that's okay. We'll have to take a poll.
It's one of my. Well, there's actually an aluminum poll that is here, and you.
I know, that's why I was making the joke.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
But right past you, Kevin.
No. I was going to say something, but I didn't. That's what I was trying to. Kept, you know, jump on it, but it didn't happen.
Pole vaulted?
Yes.
There you go.
So you're here kind of twofold. I know you're somebody who's been very active having conversations on your radio program about Donald Trump and the whole presidential, the election that we just recently had. I want to get your take on that, but before we do that, I want to give you an opportunity just to give us a little bit of an update in regards to the battle that's ongoing. I believe that the Wampanoag Indian tribe and the federal government have returned volley. Is that true?
Yeah, they have. Basically, there's been an appeal that's been filed. The appeal was filed, it shows up on the docket separately, but it's been combined and consolidated. The tribe has a different time frame within which to file their appeal documents than the government. But putting that aside, I mean, the only press release that they issued was with regard to the appeal. What most people don't know, because the tribe hasn't publicized it, is that if you picture this as a three-rung ladder, which is the record of decision, which is from the agency, going to the district court, and then going to the circuit court, and then if you want to add a fourth rung, the U.S. Supremes, they've gone from the district court, based on Judge Young's decision, back down to the agency on a remand. A remand is essentially what, if you play golf, is a mulligan. It's given to the agency to go forward and try and rewrite a decision that was fallacious to begin with. And the judge said that it was fallacious because they took the second definition of Indian under the IRA, the Indian Regulatory Act, and tried to bastardize it into something that it was not. We proved that it was not what they said it was, so they've gone from the second rung back down to the first. That really doesn't make for great press releases that you've gone backwards, but the appeal certainly does make for a wonderful press release. And one of the interesting things is that in order to do the appeal, the Solicitor General has to agree to do it. So they filed the appeal as a protective measure, which is basically a little piece of paper that says, we appeal the order of Judge Young of such and such date, and his decision on the motion for reconsideration of such and such date. They put that piece of paper in, and an appeal is locked in. It does not mean that they will continue with the appeal, and currently the Solicitor General's office still has yet to make a determination as to whether or not they will go forward with that appeal. So while papers have been filed, we don't know if the Solicitor General's office will go forward. There may be some discussion about that that's different because you now have a new administration and you're now going to have a new U.S. attorney.
Mm.
So there may be a question as to whether or not that in fact goes forward. As to the remand is set right now for the agency to take in information on whether the tribe was under federal jurisdiction in 1934, despite three federal court cases that say they weren't a tribe, they weren't under federal jurisdiction, a number of things. That is due from the tribe on January 6th. We then have 30 days from that date, regardless of when they put in their papers, to respond with all the information that we claim shows they were not under federal jurisdiction in 1934, which includes the New Seabury case and the case that the tribe brought against the Department of the Interior and a number of others that concluded in them not being a tribe and not being under federal jurisdiction. Then they have, so that's February 6th, and then they have another 15 days from that to put in a reply to whatever we put in, and then the federal government, the Department of the Interior, will make a decision as to whether or not they were under federal jurisdiction in 1934.
How do you keep it all straight in your head? How do you do it? Because, I mean...
I wear very tight shoes.
I'm just kidding. I mean, you're very fluid in how you're laying out how the process... I mean, you know, you're an attorney. You know this stuff. This is stuff that, you know, you're trained in this. This is stuff that case law, you follow it. And also, you've been invested in this from day one as being a Middleborough selectman. So you've kind of watch this progress as it has evolved and been on top of it. So you're well vested in it. But most people who are listening are like going, oh, wow, how is he able to follow that process flawlessly?
As an attorney, one of the things you do is you find that the level of care that you need to give your clients is paramount to everything else. Mm. So when you become invested in a case, and I take very few of them, because I need to be invested in the goal of the case. When you take a case and you are passionate about it and you are goal-oriented about it, you make sure that you understand its components and you make sure that you understand your client's needs and you move forward on it. I mean, one of the things about law that has changed over time is that law used to be a service industry. My parents were both the old-fashioned attorneys that believe that if you put 110% into any case that you did, win, lose, or draw, your clients would come back to you. And that is part of being a service industry. It has now become about money, and it has now become about politics. Mm. I keep these things straight because I care about them.
Okay.
If I didn't care about them, I wouldn't take the case.
Well, you would think that most attorneys would care about each and every case.
Well, some attorneys, and I'm not specifying anyone, some attorneys care about the economics that they're going to draw from each case and the billable hours that they're going to get, and whether or not they're going to make enough billable hours to become partner.
Okay.
I don't have that problem. I'm in a solo practice, actually with quite a wonderful senior associate, Charles Bassler, who believes the same way I do that service to the client is paramount, money is secondary.
Okay. Michael, did you have a question on this, or did you want to jump ahead to the Donald Trump?
Well, I do want to ask Adam a question, and maybe I missed this. Two things. Number one, are you representing the tribe, and then you described a step ladder down. Is it beneficial for the tribe that it is now going back, stepping back?
Okay, the first question sounded like you asked me if I'm representing the tribe.
And he is not.
He is not.
He is representing...
I'm quite on the opposite side.
Right, he's actually representing a group of East Taunton residents who are brought suit against the tribe who are building
residents.
It.
Okay. Residents, okay.
Sorry about
that. Okay.
Yes.
The secondary aspect of your question, which makes a lot of sense, is that you typically do not want to go backwards in litigation. Going backwards in litigation is like being penalized. You have to go back to the first hole and keep your strokes. That's economically disastrous, and from a legal standpoint, it means you have to you have to shed blood for the same property again. Something Patton said he never wanted to do, which is, you know, shed more blood for the same piece of real estate. They are in a position where they have been set back on their heels and pushed back to the agency.
Okay.
The agency to try and make a determination that they screwed up the first time. And if they truly had the basis for making the initial determination, they wouldn't have tried this alternative definition.
Right.
So go ahead.
So now basically, everybody's feet are being put to the fire to actually prove the issue that everybody was talking about in the first place.
Okay. Last question on this subject. So when do you expect to, when do we expect to hear any further news on this case or where things are? Is it right now it's kind of status quo when we wait for a court date or something from the judge?
From the tribe, you will probably hear nothing about the remand.
Okay.
It's an embarrassment to them. It's a victory to us.
Okay.
You may hear from the remand from me. I may give you a call and tell you, hey, on the remand, this is what they put in on their initial document.
Okay.
But you're ultimately going to hear sometime after February 20th what the BIA or the Secretary of the Interior is going to decide with regard to under federal jurisdiction. Prior to that, you may hear that the Solicitor General has decided not to take the appeal up with regard to the other issue that we were dealing with, which is the second definition of Indian under the IRA.
Okay.
Was that too methodical for you?
No. It was perfect. It was perfect. I want to find a clever segue to get you talking about one of the things I know that you have regular conversations on your radio program.
If Donald Trump appoints the next U.S. Supreme Court, what will that do?
That could be interesting.
Is that a segue for you?
That's it. Yeah. Well, what's your thought?
I think, quite frankly, we would win either way on this case. But, you know, whereas we would probably have a 60-40 chance before a liberal court, we would have a 80-20 chance before a court that was very conservative and actually read the law in the way it should be read. I think, ultimately, the biggest problem that I have with the Trump administration is I'm not so worried about the law. I'm not so worried about the law as I am about how the country is going to go with the Trump presidency. That's the difficulty I have. I mean, you take a look at what he's done with Taiwan. You take a look at what he does on tweet. You take a look at the way he is completely imbalanced. I really don't want to live in an imbalanced world. I understand that it may help the case that I'm fighting right now, but an imbalanced world is a really difficult thing to deal with when you have Trump as your president.
Well, and it's funny that you mention that, because we had Congressman Stephen Lynch on, and he expressed some of his concerns about the incoming administration and some of the things that this new, you know, the new president will in his administration. You know, already some of the traits that they're showing, some of the stuff that's already happening, whether it's, you know, you have right now with the current, the tail end of this administration is calling for some kind of an investigation into the Russians, you know, hacking into emails and being disruptive of our, you know, of our political process here.
I really don't have a problem with anybody investigating that, and it seems that it's bipartisan at the end of the day, and that's fine.
Mm.
But, you know, you've got to get over the fact that you've got an individual who is sitting there, and this is a picture I have in my mind, of President-elect Trump going into his gold-gilded bedroom with his silk sheets, sitting in his bathrobe in fuzzy slippers and boxer shorts, texting about China in a manner that's going to get us into a war.
Right.
Or tweeting. I mean, this is one, not presidential. Two, the lack of decorum is incredible. Do it at a press conference, and at the end of the day, at least go out and get your briefings from the intelligence community. The same intelligence community that has come together and basically said the Russians have hacked. I don't care one way or the other with regard to the election. I care about the fact that a foreign entity has hacked into whatever they've hacked into in order to try and affect the election in the United States. This is not a Hillary or Trump issue on at the end of the day. Like the bipartisan group of people that have gotten together and talked about it, this is something about a foreign nation trying to change our elections.
Right.
I mean, it's simple in that respect. And for Trump to sit there and say, well, no, this is ridiculous, this is nonsense, is for him to sit there and say that our intelligence community is worthless to him. It's worthless to him.
Well, it kind of goes against the Make America Great, you know, the slogan and what his premise was to run. I mean, I would think that you'd want to put America first. And if you have, you know, Russia, you know, folks in Russia who are hacking into, you know, our systems here, wouldn't you be worried about that? That should be one of the things you're worried about is, I mean, the silent war, what's happening on the interwebs. Wouldn't you want to make sure that that's one area that you, you know, that you solidify other than your military and having a good foreign policy? And I think the start, you know, I mean, this right is just continuing the issues with bad foreign policy by allowing Putin and the Russians to do what they're doing.
I'm not worried about continuing foreign policy in a particular way. What I'm worried about is stability. And I got to tell you, at the end of the day, I look at this man and I say he either has dementia or he's just freaking nuts. And the crazy thing about all of this with Donald Trump is that there is no stability in the manner in which he does things. Mm. There's no method to his absolute and utter madness. And you know, you can't necessarily run. Look, if you and I are going to sit there and do a business deal, at the end of the day, when I screw you on that business deal, you don't have nukes to bomb me with.
Right.
You don't have troops to send across the border and into my apartment to gather me up. He's dealing with things that are bigger than he is, and he doesn't have the intellectual curiosity to investigate why people have done what they've done, because he believes he knows better than all the generals, he knows better than the intelligence community, he knows better than anybody what there is to be done, yet he has not been focused on what the resources of a country that is pissed at him. He's certainly been in litigations. He's certainly been in business wars with people.
Right.
But this is dealing with a country. This is dealing with people that have guns and bullets and bombs. They're fine. They pick up a drone today, they bomb someplace in Southeast Asia tomorrow. And this is what bothers me. He's sort of belittled what we have right now. And unfortunately, it reminds you of 1939 Germany.
Okay.
I'm sorry. That's where it puts my mind, is sitting there and looking at the... Go watch the Charlie Chaplin film. What was it? The Little Dictator?
Yes.
Go watch that again, because I saw it a few nights ago. Go watch that again and see if you can picture Donald Trump with a big inflatable globe bouncing it around and singing on stage.
Okay. Michael, do you have a follow-up question?
Just a quick question. Economically speaking, he is going to be challenging trade agreements, devaluation of currency in China and things like that. Again, it's going to probably be an ugly process. Do you think he'll be successful in just an economic standpoint?
From an economic standpoint, one of the things is the devaluation of currency over time has been shown not to be a manipulation as much as it has been a protection. But putting that aside, I don't have a problem in the same way, and I got to tell you, I wasn't a great Obama supporter, wasn't a great Hillary Clinton supporter, wasn't a great Trump supporter. At the end of the day, Obama and Hillary Clinton understand how to get things done without making everybody insane.
Right.
And there's something to be said for that. So in terms of him changing policies, I don't have an issue with that, but do it in the way a sane person does it.
Do you think challenging trade agreements and things needs a little insanity to make that happen, or
no,
do you go the old
people,
route?
I think people, and I've done this in my profession too, I have challenged the status quo. If you raise your hand and politely push the status quo, and then when you get rejected, you move the status quo forward in the right momentum, you can accomplish the same goals, and in fact, more more properly accomplish the same goals rather than putting your head down, sticking your horns out, and running through the room and knocking all the china off the shelves. And I don't mean china as a pun.
There's
a methodology of communication in law. There's a methodology of communication in medicine, in plumbing, in radio, where people have established mores for talking to each other. And there are mores for talking to each other that allow him the ability to change trade policies without basically going in there, taking his foot and kicking over the apple cart and saying, to hell with all of you. I know better. And that's the problem. He is a 5-year-old child. I apologize to 5-year-old children. I don't mean to insult them. He is a 5-year-old child who has now got the biggest stick in the room. And that's a problem to me. I don't mind, like I said, I don't mind the change in policies. Go ahead and change them. But do them in a traditional manner that does not put everybody completely on their arched up. I mean, look at China. China is getting ready to retaliate. We don't know how they're going to retaliate. We've got other countries in the world that are nervous as hell. You've got an ambassador to Israel that is going to make the Palestinians insane. You've got him saying he's going to move the embassy to Jerusalem, which, I'm Jewish, I'm telling you, that's not a good move. Okay? So why don't we just go and do what Donald Trump wants to do and set fires all over the globe and hope to God that nobody shoots back? That's not the way to conduct business.
Yep.
And while I may not have agreed with many of the other people that ran, you know what? At the end of the day, they would have done what they're going to do in a fashion that makes some sense. And I don't have to agree with everybody that's right out there. I really don't. But at the same time, I would find stability in Hillary Clinton. And in fact, I voted for Hillary Clinton. So you're sitting here and you're looking at the world. And now, and what else do you have? What else do you have out there? You've got him being a misogynist. You've got him being, I don't know, somewhat angled on racial issues. You've got him angled on international issues. You've got him angled on economic issues. This is a man that is creating really big strife in the world and in this country.
Well, it's going to be a very it's going to be a very interesting 4 years. That's to say the least, Adam.
I can tell you that I don't believe that it will last 4 years.
Okay, I was going to go with his prediction of he's looking forward to the next 8 years, but I shortened it a little bit. So, but
I don't think we're going to get past his conflicts of interest.
Okay. Well, we got to wrap up the segment.
All right.
But I want to thank you for joining us. Happy holidays to you and the Bond family, to Avery and to Victoria. And we'll look forward to having you back on again to talk more about this and many other things.
And I will pass that on to my wife and my daughter.
Excellent.
You be well.
There he is, Attorney Adam Bond, who's been our guest here. And do you want to quickly, this is your last chance, Michael, to...
Call in for tickets for The Wonder of Christmas, thewonderofchristmas.net, a Christmas celebration going on through the 23rd in Brockton.
781-837-4900. You're listening to Monday Night Talk.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host Kevin Tachi on 95.9 WATD. Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we are back here on Monday Night Talk. We're going to step away from politics for the night. Gonna put them on the shelf, kind of, sort of, a little bit. As we got Marshfield's own Casey Sherman to talk about. It's not just one thing; there's so many things to talk about with you. To get an update, I know we had your colleague Dave Wedge on a couple of weeks ago.
Right,
get a little bit of a snapshot as to what was going on with him. And I'm excited to talk to you about a number of things. Probably to start out with, going to the premiere of Patriots Day, which is, of course, subsequent collaboration that was done. The movie was basically based on Boston Strong, so to speak?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, Patriots Day is really the sum of several different parts. One of them being my book with Dave Wedge called Boston Strong, which is focuses on not only the manhunt for the Sarnaev brothers after the Boston Marathon bombings, but also the survivors and how they coped and rebuilt their lives subsequent to the Boston Marathon bombing. So, you know, the premiere was a somber event. It wasn't really a celebration,
right.
But it was actually a celebration of human life. The fact that the people that were the stars of the premiere, and there was David Ortiz there, Mark Wahlberg was there as well, obviously, introducing the film, but they weren't the real stars. The stars were the survivors
who
were there that night, who were invited to the event. And really got a sense in it, because a lot of these people that we worked with on the book said, you know, we were either in comas during the manhunt for the Sarnaev brothers. We didn't know what the outside world was dealing with because we were hospitalized and we were under heavy sedation. So to see a little bit of that, or a snapshot of what that could have been like, I think was eye-opening for them.
Of course, we have Peter Brown here. We have Michael Faraday. They are my co-hosts for this evening. So, guys, if you have questions
I'm just in awe, because I remember the first time we started talking about this was just after the bombings, and it was involved in an interview with you and the inception of the book, and just to see it to come to fruition and to where it came from, it's just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's a triumph of the human spirit is really what I think Patriots Day is. The filmmakers, you know, had a very limited landscape on which to paint. Basically, they really focused on the manhunt for the bombers and really the law enforcement efforts after the bombs went off. Obviously, as a writer, you have a much broader canvas on which to paint. We were able to focus on not only the police and law enforcement aspect of what was happening, but you know, the firefighters and EMTs that responded to all of the people that were literally dying and bleeding out on Boylston Street. And had not these men and women jumped into action the way they did, more people would have been killed. As I said, we focused on the survivors and their resiliency, showing you the ups, the downs, the daily struggles and triumphs of their everyday lives, because we had a responsibility to tell people that Marathon Monday is every day for these people, and they need to be remembered. They need to be cared for, not only at a premiere of a movie, which is great, but the next day and the day after that. That has to always be, you know, if not in the front of our minds, but at least in the back of our minds, what these folks are dealing with.
What was it like sitting through the premiere? What was it like? Because you had finest hours.
Yeah, it's not my first rodeo.
Yeah, it's
Kevin,
not.
You know?
I mean, so it's like, it's not like, but Dave. It was his first.
Oh, no. As I said, it's an exciting night to be able to, you know, stage the world premiere here in Boston with the finest hours. That was a movie and a story that also happened here in Massachusetts. We did the world premiere in Hollywood, which is, you know, a whole different kind of animal in terms of the glitz and the glamour and the red carpet.
And that was Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, that was very exciting and a big, very big deal. And, you know, I thought a part of our world was in Hollywood for that day. And, you know, with Patriots Day, a part of Hollywood's world was in Boston for that day, where the survivors got to get dressed up and they got to really, you know, shine brightly under the spotlight, because they survived. They lived through it. The law enforcement officers that chased these guys for almost 5 days, they were celebrated. So it was great to sit back and watch their reaction to not only the movie, but to the entire event itself.
Gentlemen, do you have a question? I don't want to hog all the time here.
I don't know if you can answer this. My dad's former superintendent in chief of Boston Police, and he described the day of the bombing as unprecedented, number one, in shutting down the city, which was an unprecedented act. And then number two, the level of uncoordination between all of the departments and people who just showed up to help out. Can you talk a little bit about that kind of chaos that happened afterwards?
Yeah, well, the Boston Marathon bombings itself, it's literally the biggest crime scene in Boston history.
Right.
Not only did you have Boston police officers trying to actively investigate while the smoke and debris was all around them. I mean, imagine hundreds of spectators literally dropping their backpacks and being evacuated from the area. Well, in each one of those backpacks could have been a bomb. And we've all seen the movie Hurt Locker, where they get dressed up in the, you know, anti-bombing costume, if you will. There was no such protection for these police officers that day. They literally had to call, you know, what they call slash and tag each of these backpacks, opening these backpacks, you know, one zipper at a time, flinching, never knowing if they were going to lose their lives while doing it. Yeah, it was basically Russian roulette for these guys. But to your point about self-deployment, and that is something that we really stressed in our book, Boston Strong, where you had law enforcement agencies from all over New England self-deploying to various stages during this manhunt. And it all culminated in Watertown, not only with a shootout with the Sarnaev brothers on Thursday of that week, but ultimately the capture of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev on Friday of that week. Well, if you have all these self-deployed agencies, including, you know, Maine Fish and Game, mm-hmm. I mean, people that were, had, there was no central command to what was happening. So there, you know, there was a lot of friendly fire incidents, almost cost the life of Dick Donahue, the transit police officer that was shot in the leg and literally severed his femoral artery and almost bled out on a hospital bed. That was not, you know, an act of violence, you know, from a terrorist. That was a friendly fire incident. I will tell you that the Watertown police officers during that event handled themselves exactly the way they should have. I mean, it was just, these guys had never pulled their guns out of their holsters in 30 years. Some of them had been 30 years on the force and had never been in an active situation. But the way they handled themselves is the reason why one terrorist was eventually killed and the other caught.
There's buzz around this movie that it could be worthy of some hardware.
I mean, we'll see, you know. I mean,
what was your thoughts? I mean, you.
I mean, yeah,
you're gonna be a little biased,
right?
But
right. Well, I'm close to it as well, so I, you know, I mean, I need to see it a few more times to really have to digest it because it was all coming at me pretty fast and furious. You know, Dave Wedge and I, you know, read the script, we vetted the script, but when you see it actually happening, we were on the set many times.
A lot of editing going on.
Sure,
you never know.
Yeah. So you know, I think they did an admirable job. Pete Berg, who's the director, Mark Wahlberg, who's the star, at, you know, telling one side of the story, which is the law enforcement side of that story. Whether or not it's Oscar worthy, that's going to be up for the public to decide. I think it's a good film.
What's interesting, and I have it in the notes that you have there before you, is I kind of got, I don't know, it's kind of, maybe it's a fan thing or something, but like, I got Netflix, and I was going through, I go, oh my God, they added Finest Hours to Netflix.
How cool is that? That's very cool. That actually happened in September, and it was the highest rated live action movie on Netflix that month. It was amazing that the movie came out, you know, last January. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people didn't see it at the theaters because it's in the middle of the wintertime. And, you know, movies today in theaters only last 2-3 weeks tops before another movie takes over. If you're lucky.
You
know, Finest Hours did okay in the theaters, but where it really took off was on Netflix. And I get emails from and texts and Twitter messages from people, you know, all over the country, all over the world, that say, you know, we just saw this movie last night. It's the best movie we've ever seen. And that really makes me feel good, not because I wrote the book that the movie's based on, but because I was able to share the story of these real heroes. And every time I hear a story about the Finest Hours, I always kind of look to the heavens, if you will, guys, and think about Bernie Weber and the three crew members that are no longer with us on that little lifeboat, and think, you see, guys, what impact you've had 60 years after what you did. You know, it's an amazing thing.
It was a great movie. I did see that movie too on Netflix.
Oh, thank you. No, I appreciate that.
Now, now that's the past. Let's look a little forward here. Skeletons of the City.
Skeletons of the City is an idea that I had a few years ago develop a true crime travel show. I was in London on vacation, and I went to a tavern called Ten Bells, which is basically where Jack the Ripper's victims were working out of at the time. It was this little hole-in-the-wall tavern on East London off any tourism map that you could find, but the place was packed with tourists from all over the world, you know, because they knew the Ripper story. They wanted to touch and feel that part of, macabre history of London. And I thought, you know what, there could be a show here. So Skeletons of the City is a show where I would be hosting a show, taking you, the viewer, to cities, you know, in America, cities internationally, and focusing on three or four historic crimes that transform the history of these cities. It's one thing to see the, you know, the Eiffel Tower in France or the Statue of Liberty in New York City, but if I can show you an interesting crime that you probably walk past every day and never know that existed, you know, I think there's a an interesting story to be told.
I said that wrong. Skeletons of the City with Casey Shrimp.
That's right.
Is that the actual title, right?
I hope so. Yeah. So, you know, we just shot the pilot, and the network, CNN, will ultimately decide whether or not to order it into series. But we shot the pilot in Boston, and we focused on, you know, I could go back to Boston, you know, 10 different seasons and find, you know, three different crimes. So obviously the first episode we focus on the Boston Strangler case, which I'm very close to, but I also focus on, you know, the organized crime in Boston, not the Whitey Bulger case. Everybody knows about that. But I wrote the book called Animal, which is about the beginning and the origins of law enforcement's relationship with organized crime back in the 1960s. But I didn't want to be too macabre on the show. I want to have a little fun with it as well. So we also focused on the Hotel Buckminster, which is right across the street from Fenway Park. And in room 615 of that hotel, that's where the Chicago White Sox in 1919 plotted to throw the World Series.
The Black Sox scandal.
The Black Sox scandal. You know, Kevin Costner would never have plowed that field of corn had it not been for the Hotel Buckminster in Boston.
Right, right, right. That's awesome. And I mean, how deep are your stories? I mean, how many have you lined up that you're going through?
Well, we've lined up, you know, 8 cities for season one. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, these are cities that we can constantly go back to. I've got a story that we hope to do in L.A. called It's the Wrong Way Raid. And basically, there was a woman who was in her 30s, and this was early 1950s. Somebody breaks down her door with an axe. 4 guys walk into her apartment. They see her, and then they stumble out into the night. When the police show up and ask her if she got a fresh eye on her assailants, she said, exactly. They said, well, who were they? Well, it was Frank Sinatra, Joe DiMaggio, George Raft, and a couple of other actors. They thought this woman was crazy. And she would call the police for weeks on end afterwards. What are you doing about the robbery, and how are you going to fix my door? Oh, it's the lady that thinks Frank Sinatra broke down her door? Well, a year later, a private investigator who was arrested on an unrelated crime mentions this story to LAPD. I was with DiMaggio and Sinatra the night they broke down that woman's door. And they called it the Wrong Way Raid because they were actually looking for Marilyn Monroe, who was allegedly, you know, having an affair with her voice coach right after, you know, splitting with DiMaggio.
DiMaggio, right.
So you have 3 drunken superstars breaking down this door, and this woman in curlers sees it and is you know, called a nutcase for a few years. So that's, you know, and that apartment building still exists in Hollywood. So we're going to take you to that apartment building and show you how that happened.
What's the design of the show? Is it an hour long, and how many packages are within that show?
It's an hour long show, and it depends on the stories themselves. The stories will dictate the breadth of each story. Okay. You know, we want to at least do 3 stories, but, you know, there might be a story like in San Francisco. If we focus on all the locations in connection with the Zodiac Killer case, that could take an hour. And that needs to take an hour to breathe and to really gain a perspective that hasn't been seen before on television.
Before I move on to the next, did you guys want to ask a question in regards to that?
Would you ever write directly to screenplay?
I have.
Seeing as, oh, you have.
Yeah, I've got a screenplay called Turk, and that is the true story of Derek Sanderson. Turk Sanderson and his relationship with Bobby Orr. And we're continuously trying to bring that to fruition in Hollywood. You know, it's what we call stuck in development hell right now, and development on a film can take anywhere between 3 years, like Patriots Day, or 25 years. you know, Unforgiven, which is an incredible classic Clint Eastwood movie, took 20 years to make. So you never know. You know, you just have to keep many logs in the fire.
Is the word optioned? Has it been optioned or acquired? Are they sitting on it right now?
No. I mean, we own the property, so we have, you know, we have a development company that we're working with. That, you know, we want to, basically the easiest way to make a movie like this is to partner with a studio and build out a budget of maybe $25 million to get a really A-list actor. We could go out today, shoot the movie for six, get some up-and-coming actors to play these roles, but these are iconic roles. I don't want, you know, some kid fresh out of acting school to play Bobby Orr. I want that to be somebody that can really bring depth to that role. So we're being patient with it. We know we have a great story to tell, and ultimately we'll tell it.
And you've expanded your horizons beyond being an author, being an investigative journalist and producer, being somebody who's done screenplays. Now you have a production company. Tell us about the production company. Folks don't know. And again, we're speaking with Casey Sherman. Tell us about the production company. And I believe you also made an acquisition in regards to a story.
Yeah, we've actually made several. You know, I had the idea of starting my own production company about a year ago because, you know, before that, I would have a piece of property, one of my books. I would partner with a producer in Hollywood who would then partner with the studio and eventually get it made. That's basically what happened with The Finest Hours, basically what happened with Boston Strong, which eventually became Patriots Day. And I thought, well, why don't I start my own company where I can not only focus on my own work, but harvest stories that I don't have to write? And I've got the relationships and the partnerships with Hollywood now that I can bring these directly to the studios myself and cultivate them and ultimately make them. Now, I couldn't do that by myself, so I reached back to the people that I trust in my life, one of them being my co-author, Dave Wedge, who's a brilliant, not only a brilliant writer, but he's got a great nose for a good story.
Yeah, awesome guy, too.
He's a great guy.
Awesome guy.
Yeah. Our other partner is a producer named Ted Collins. I grew up with Ted Collins on Cape Cod. We graduated Barnstable High School 1987 together. He went to Emerson College and eventually became a producer in Hollywood. He understands how to budget films. We understand, you know, how to really tell stories.
You get the key components
to this
group, yes.
You know, we understand, you know, our different skill sets complement each other. And over the past several months, we've been able to acquire some incredible properties, not just, you know, stories that Dave and I are writing or I'm writing with somebody else, but stories that somebody else has written that we think might make for a great, great movie.
I don't know how to, and the name, is it Witta?
Witta.
Witta. And you, I believe you acquired the story of that ship.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Well, Witta,
I was fascinated that you guys made that acquisition.
Well, you know, I came up with the name Witta Productions because I was always fascinated about this this pirate story off the coast of Cape Cod, which happened back in the 1700s.
Right.
One of my partners, Ted Collins, he grew up with that tale as well. Somebody else grew up with that tale. His name is Barry Clifford. He's a renowned underwater explorer, and when he was 8 years old, he had heard the story about a pirate ship that that wrecked off Wellfleet back in 1717. Supposedly had left maybe $400 million worth of treasure at the bottom of the ocean. Now, growing up on the Cape, you know, that becomes legend, that becomes hearsay. Well, he dedicated his life to proving that it was actually the case. And with his first mate, who was John F. Kennedy Jr., a young Brown University college student at the time, an expert diver, they gathered this motley crew of divers together, and they were able to find and discover the first and only authenticated pirate ship in world history, which is the Witta pirate ship. And just so happens that we were able to meet with Barry Clifford himself several months ago, convinced him we were the right guys to tell this story, and now hopefully we're going to bring that story to the big screen.
Wow. And as though that ain't enough, he's also working on a new book with Dave.
Yep, I'm working on a couple new books.
That's right. I always forget that you have so many. That's why I asked you earlier, are you cloned? Because you're doing so many things.
I'm like a possum. I sleep on a branch, you know, for 2 hours a night. I'm nocturnal.
That I know of.
Yeah, let's talk about Challenge. Challenge is, you know, I almost look at it as almost a trilogy in terms of Finest Hours, Boston Strong, and Challenge, because it's all about triumph of the human spirit with these books. Challenge is about a young man at war with his own body. Peter Frates, who we all know, was diagnosed at 28 years old with Lou Gehrig's disease. And instead of, you know, writing that off as a death sentence, which I probably would have done in his shoes.
Most of us would have.
Most of us would have done that. He declared it as his mission in life, that this is what he was put on the world to do, on Earth to do, rather, was to find a cure for this dreaded disease. And he inspired the infamous, or not infamous, but celebrated Ice Bucket Challenge in 2014. And within only a period of 31 days, they were able to raise $220 million.
Fascinating.
Through people dumping ice on their heads, whether it be Justin Timberlake, whether it be, you know, my two daughters, everybody's family members.
The president of the United States.
Yeah, exactly. We all did it.
Yeah.
But there's an incredible story about a family behind it.
Sure.
And it's the greatest social media campaign in world history. And we're going to tell the story about the impactful people in Pete's life. His mother, Nancy. His wife, Julie, who's stood by him throughout this entire horrific episode. These are stories that we think will inspire the world.
Well, we're looking forward to it. When do you think you'll have the first? Is the first draft close?
Yeah, first draft's close. The book is going to come out in the fall of 2017. At the same time that my other book, which is called Above and Beyond, which is about the Cuban Missile Crisis and two of the U-2 airmen who are thrust into the spotlight.
Sure.
And that's a very intimate look at an incredibly historic event. So both books will be coming at it at approximately the same time.
So you'll definitely be out on tour.
We're going to be out on tour, yeah. And then, you know, with Challenge, we've already negotiated a film deal for it. So we're going to be, not only working on the book, but really working with our partners in Hollywood to make this an incredible movie like we think it will be.
Well, congratulations and continued success. Gentlemen, any last questions to our guest, Casey Sherman?
I'm just in awe of what's going on, and I'm privileged to be sitting here next to you this, thinking about all the things that have been going on the past four years.
It just goes to show with hard work and you know how to sniff out a story or at least follow up on things. I mean, there's so many things that you're working on that a lot of people wish that they had that drive and aptitude to be able to do it.
Well, we feel very blessed and honored. I mean, we feel like we're conduits of those stories. They're the real heroes.
Right.
You know, it's our responsibility, to share these stories. I mean, we have a whole generation of kids right now who think superheroes are, Marvel comic characters and Avenger movies, when there are real heroes that exist in our communities.
Here today. They walk amongst you.
They walk amongst us all.
And we need people like you and Dave Wedge to get those
tell
stories.
Tell those stories.
Yeah, if we can shed the spotlight on these great stories, then we think we've done a job well done.
Good job.
Last question I'll ask you. Are you all set and ready for the holidays? I know you have children.
I do. I have two children here in Marshfield. One's a high school student, one's a middle school student. So
bless
they're
you,
probably listening tonight.
Awesome.
I'm, Santa is actively at work.
Awesome.
Doing what Santa does in the North Pole. So if they've been good all year, we'll see what they get.
It'll pay off.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Well, we look forward to talking to you in the new year. And
appreciate
continued
it, guys.
Success.
Thank you.
And thank you again for
all right,
for joining
thank you.
Us.
No, my pleasure. Thank you, guys. You do a great job.
Do you want to sit in? We got George Earl from Marshfield Community Christmas. Any interest in chatting with George at all? Or do you have...
I've got to go. These
you
books
strap
don't
the cape
write,
on. I know.
These books don't write themselves, guys. That's the thing. I got to get back to the Batcave and do some work.
All right, Bruce. We'll talk to you later.
We'll see.
And we'll definitely look forward to talking to you in 2017.
Sounds good, guys. Thanks.
There he is. Casey Sherman has been our guest telling us about the numerous projects that he's been working on, starting, of course, talking about the Patriots Day premiere that took place. Now, gentlemen, if you'll put your headphones on, joining us on the phone line is Mr. George Earl with Marshfield Community Christmas. George, how are you?
Well, I'm going crazy right now.
No, don't go crazy, dude. You still got five more days to go.
Yeah, I know, and we're behind again. It's like a horse race here, neck to neck. Every time people apply, that kind of puts us behind the behind the eight ball there again. So we have to try and raise money for that family. We averaged out to between $290 to $300 per family, and every time one family walks through the door, it's that that amount of money. And pretty soon when you get to have, you know, a half a dozen walking at the same time, you're like, uh-oh, you know, we've got to get the donations in so we can buy the gifts for the children and stuff, you know.
Where do you stand right now with 5 days to go? I mean, our donations, what do you need to do to bump up those donations? Whether it's toys, gift cards, or maybe even some kind of a check or something.
Okay, this is where the need is on us. We need teenage items. Any kind of a teenage item would be great. We were so, you know, we always far behind on those, and people always buy for the little kids, but we got so many teenagers that, you know, if people could buy our teenage gift, that would save us having to get out there the last minute and run around. So we need people's help again, you know.
Michael, Peter, do you have questions?
Hey, George, this is Peter from Tiny and Sons. How are you?
How you doing, Peter?
Good. Anything that we can do as far as businesses out there give you a hand with?
Well, the same thing. It's, you know, it's if you want to dig up donations for us.
Well, that's the purpose of having you on, George. The kind folks who are still listening to Monday Night Talk, of course, coming up at 8 o'clock is South Shore Live with Stan and the Gang, so be sure to stay tuned for that. I believe my buddy Jerry Thornton is going to be on with them at some point this evening, so stay tuned for that. But, George, you're on these final few minutes just to kind of, you know, give folks an opportunity who are, maybe they want to donate something or help out a cause. That's where you come in and say, please contact us. Here's the number. Or go to our website, MarshfieldCommunityChristmas.com.
Absolutely. Our number is... Marshfield Community Christmas, P.O. Box 713, Marshfield, Mass. 02050. Mm-hmm. We can be reached at the fairgrounds 12:30 to 6 every day. That phone number is 781-837-8405. And, you know, it's again, the race is on, and we really need your help. You know, this is a neighbor helping neighbor. This is not a handout. This is a Christmas gift, and no child should go without Christmas, you know?
I totally agree with you.
No.
Michael, question?
I just want to say I'm totally impressed with the spirit of giving that your organization has, and that is really the true meaning of Christmas.
Well, let me tell you something about our community. You know, I moved here 40 years ago, and I picked the right town. The people in this town are great. I get to meet most of them through the organization, you know, they come through the door there. And I'll tell you, this is one volunteer in town, and I am really proud to be, you know, a townie, if you want to call that, but I wasn't born here. But there's so many nice, you know, there's no strangers coming through the door. It's just friends I haven't met yet, you know?
Okay. Mm. Well, George, we want to thank you very much. We're just about out of time here, but I want to make sure that I gave you a few moments to get the word out to folks who are interested in donating, if they're looking for a charity to give to. I know that's what some folks like to do, and I am one of those who likes to give to people any way that I can, and so that's why we have you on here to kind of share your thoughts and get folks motivated to help others who are in need, because you never know that this time of year, whether it's a family that's down in their luck financially, maybe maybe it's a parent that's in between jobs, that is, you know, struggling to pay the rent, whatever it may be, you know, it's our job, those who do have, to give to those who do not.
Absolutely. We're up to 200 families right now. So, and let me tell you something. When you interview, you know, I'm glad we can do Christmas, but they have other problems that you can't believe, you know?
Right.
So, anyways.
And if anybody wanted to drop something off, I believe they can go to the, couldn't they go to the fairgrounds and drop it off between 1 and 5?
Yeah, 7 days a week, 12:30 to 6.
12:30 to 6. And that's, it's easy to do. Well, listen, George, Merry Christmas, my friend.
Merry Christmas, both of you up
Merry
there.
Merry Christmas.
I hope you're successful in being able to get folks to raise enough money and donate cards or bring toys for the teens in need. And we'll look forward to talking to you soon.
Well, thank you very much, and have a Merry Christmas.
You got
it. Merry Christmas, George.
Bye-bye.
Michael, I want to thank you very much for joining us and hanging out here. Anything, any grievances we want to air for Festivus?
I got one of my Christmas presents off the hook here.
Do you really?
Yeah, Casey was kind enough to autograph my book for me.
Oh.
Yeah.
I forgot to tell you about the signature fee that I charge.
I already paid it.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
It was great to have you two gentlemen in here this evening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And big plans for the holidays? Yes, no? That's why I closed that door.
Pizza.
We already got the next show already trying
good
to move
job.
In here on us.
I think that's our food, so we can go
you
out
think
there.
You think that's
and
what
eat.
It is?
Yeah.
From Peel Pizza?
No, we're going to be spending time at my sister's house on Christmas Eve decorating cookies and talking about stories about my dad, so I'm looking forward to
it. You get that loud hooligan, Jerry Thornton, is already here.
Yeah, there he is.
He's going to be in on with Stan, South Shore Life. Actually, this is breaking news. Actually, I've already signed Jerry for 7:30 next week, so he will be here next week to talk a little sports. So anything that you don't catch between 8 and 9 o'clock, he'll regurgitate at 7:30 next week. Hey, listen.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas Merry to Christmas. One and all. We will have a live show next week, so stay tuned. 6:15 p.m. next week. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Festivus.